and welcome to the Houston Innovators Podcast. I'm Natalie Harms, editor of Innovation Map. My guest for today is Youngro Lee, founder and CEO of Brassica Technologies, a fintech company that's creating a more modern and holistic approach to investing in alternative assets. Youngro has spent over a decade on a mission of democratizing investment, first as a founder and CEO of Nexseed, up until the company was acquired by Republic. Now he oversees Republic's expansion in the Asia market, as well as leading his new endeavor. Youngro joins the show today to discuss the details of his new company and the future of fintech. Hi, Youngro. Thanks for joining me today.
Hey, Natalie. Thanks for having me. Good to see you again.
Yeah, well, welcome back to the show, I guess is what I should say, even though it's been a while, I think a couple years since you've been on the podcast, but glad to have you back. So it's been a minute since we've chatted, but also now you have a whole new endeavor that you're focused on. So tell me a little bit about Brassica and what sparked this interest in starting a new venture.
Yeah, it's funny. Brassica is, I personally consider a extension and maybe a natural evolution from my original starting point, which, as you know, and the Houston community knows as Nexseed, which is to basically democratize finance so that everyone can have access to alternative assets as part of their just wealth management, investment, or even for pleasure, to the extent some people just want to invest in things that they believe in. And so Brassica, to be technical, is a fintech infrastructure company that's providing the related and necessary or certain related and necessary financial infrastructure that alternative investment businesses require. So to put that in layman's terms, when you buy stocks, you probably go to a online brokerage, or the average person does, you know, whether it's Fidelity, you know, whatever, right? And it's a known process where people just go online and buy something on the stock market. Robinhood is obviously that's a fintech version of it. In the alternative asset space, so basically anything that's not public stocks, what do? Right? Like you don't go to anywhere. You kind of have to know when and how to buy it. And traditionally, you buy things like whether it's real estate or private companies, especially startups in recent years as that got hot. Like you kind of have to know, you know, either a person who has something to sell, or you go to these online platforms that systematically offers these services. What you as an investor and really the overall market hasn't been able to really create a seamless solution is the back end. And the back end is things like custody of those assets. It's how do you transfer those assets? How do you fund those assets? How do you keep track of those assets? Because all of these things are real significant issues. And if you don't have them, then obviously bad things can occur. And we can obviously talk about that in more detail. But the reason why I got into this space and I thought this was where I want to focus on next was exactly because it was an issue that I struggled with as a founder of Nexseed. When on the front end, if you will, we're really trying to connect, you know, small businesses, individual investors to participating and work with each other. And then when I personally transitioned to Republic, same thing with startups and really other asset classes. But the back end was always an issue, right? There's not one single vendor that we felt really understood our business, that was doing it efficiently, that enabled us to deliver those related services to our end clients. And so I guess, you know, everything happens for a reason. When I had an opportunity to work on this problem specifically as a direct result of our partnership with Republic, I decided, hey, let's do it.
Yeah. So how does the technology work exactly to solve these problems that you're describing?
Yeah. So obviously we're ourselves a startup, so we're going to be aggressively building along the way. But we have under the Brassica family, let's say, specifically legally regulated entities, two. One is an SEC registered transfer agent. And this is a legal entity that tracks the beneficial ownership of an asset. So if you're familiar with Carta, from a startup perspective, that's what they are. They're a transfer agent that's really revolutionized. You know, startup investing, because it allows investors to keep track of their private investments in a compliant way and have comfort that they're doing it right. That's one component of our business. And this, the other part of our business is a trust company. We recently received a Wyoming trust charter from the state of Wyoming. And in essence, that trust company will allow us, the trust company, to custody on behalf of different clients, issuers, businesses, investors, simply custody your assets. Just like you go to a bank to put your cash and you custody your public securities at Fidelity or Schwab or whatnot. That's the function. And I think the big difference and the innovation part, if you will, those services, that we are now able to provide those services in a development-friendly way, a tech development-friendly way. So it's not that a client would necessarily come knock on our physical office and, hey, I have X dollars, please, you know, manage it for us. But really, we're making the tools available to other managers and other enterprises who themselves want services, so they can build on top of our APIs to build the customer experience they want for their clients, for their asset class, for their industry.
What's been the most challenging aspect of mapping out this company and the services you're going to provide amid this, what I would imagine is a pretty complicated regulatory and maybe changing ecosystem?
There's definitely a lot happening these days. So we've been working on this project for over 2 years now. And just obviously recently, we have come out of stealth and now talking more publicly about it. And one of the challenges is, in fact, that the reality changes pretty quickly. This time last year, everyone thought, you know, crypto and digital assets, for example, was going to be great. It's going to change everything. And it still will, or it may will, it may be. But obviously, there's been significant events last year, headlined by the FTX breakdown, let's say. And that has caused a lot of different effects, including heightened regulatory kind of frameworks that the U.S. government and different agencies are imposing on the industry to avoid those kind of situations in the future. And obviously, it wasn't just FTX. There's a lot of other incidences that kind of led to the outcome, but nonetheless, that is the outcome. And more recently, there's been obviously a significant banking crisis with the fall of Silicon Valley Bank and all these other issues. And independent of those kind of financial market related issues, there's been global macro trends, right? Like obviously the war in Ukraine won, not just that, bunch of geopolitical concerns across the world. And there's just so many different things, like not to mention, obviously, hopefully we're past the COVID stage, but obviously there has been lingering effects of the health pandemic from several years ago. So all those combined like circumstances is what makes it very difficult to create a new business, especially in a regulated context. And I would say that challenge is the same now as I had when I started Nexi, because it was the same thing. The Jobs Act literally wasn't even implemented. It was announced, but it was not implemented by the SEC when I started Nexi. And so we had to kind of imagine what the world could look like and use our best guesses, frankly, to build out the solution in advance so that when the market was ready to adopt, we can implement those our products. And that's kind of what I've been doing, what myself and my team have been doing over the last couple of years, is imagine what the world looks like when we believe it turns in a certain way, which is a more regulated world, a more knowledgeable consumer base, because they now have experience of investing and, for a lot of people, losing money in alternative assets and digital assets. And one very significant factor is the adoption from institutional investors, because that's always happens. Like the retail, the early adopters are usually retail, and they're the ones that are willing to take, you know, significant risks in ways institutional investors are not. But what's happening right now is institutional investors across all categories of alternative assets, not just digital assets, are in fact looking to increase their exposure in this space. And so we drew a map. I mean, that's probably the best way to think about this. We drew a map, a virtual map in our minds, and we built a business plan around it. And that's, you know, ultimately the startup journey, right? Like you have to believe something when others don't, and you have to be willing to put your money and, you know, resources behind it and hope that you're right as the journey continues.
Yeah, I'm very far from a fintech expert, but from my understanding of everything you just outlined and what you're trying to do with this, it's not, alternative assets aren't a new industry. You're just bringing it into a modern way of investing, right? Which almost reminds me a little bit of crypto and how this is a new way of investments, and that obviously attracted a lot of people. So it almost feels like this is a great opportunity for you, which is probably why you're doing it, is because there's this buzz with people putting their money into crypto, which didn't necessarily.
For sure, the digital assets and the rise and the fluctuation of digital asset industry is a big driver to, I think, a lot of things that's happening in the world, especially the financial regulations. From a company development perspective, one thing to highlight is Braska is a B2B company. So unlike my previous startups, we're not selling to an individual consumer, right? At least not yet. We are specifically selling to enterprises and institutions who would like to build products on top of the infrastructure, because infrastructure is not easy to create, right? If it was easy, everyone would do it. And that's kind of what, I mean, kind of going back to my earlier kind of intro, that's what I keenly recognized and understood and believe was necessary for the industry to truly take off, right? Like, it doesn't matter that there's investor demand for certain assets. It doesn't even matter if there are, like other players wanting in the game. If you literally don't have the right infrastructure to support it, it won't scale. And the global markets, not just the US, the global markets, there is not a infrastructure network set up that allows the industry to scale. And what I mean by that is, if you think about the global kind of private equity alternative asset industry, by definition, those are institutional investors. In fact, not to make it too technical, like, the whole point of the Jobs Act was to make the access to those investments more available to the regular people and allowing non-accredited investors to invest. And so the traditional infrastructure, if you will, is designed specifically for very wealthy and very large institutions and firms. So that's not a political statement, that's a fact. And so what that means in real life is you have individuals at banks and trust companies and other kind of what you would consider back-end service providers that are doing manual efforts, right, in enabling these trades and transactions. And that's exactly how it was in the public securities market as well, until the rise of groups like Fidelity and Schwab that truly use technology to innovate on those solutions. And so from our perspective, we are trying to figure out how to bring the infrastructure of the alternative space to modern day, fit.
So you mentioned working on this for about 2 years before you came out of stealth. What was that process like, specifically fundraising? Because with the announcement and going public with this information of what you're doing, and not going public as a company, I guess. But what was it like, raising the money in stealth?
I think from a fundraising perspective, as you cover in this podcast a lot, it's a black box, right? There's no easy way to raise money. There's no easy way to do anything as you relate to the process, including searching for investors. That's one of the things that I have gone, fortunately, more familiar with and more experienced over the last almost decade of working in this industry. So from our perspective, it was really knowing when to talk to who. We actually, when we started this venture, arising out of Nexseed and then with the support of Republic, we as in like myself and Republic even, like, we didn't know necessarily where this project was going to go, right? It was a corporate initiative to try to understand like what the market needs, because we need it. And if we need it, as we believe we were one of the innovators in this industry, and clearly other people would need it as well. And it was over the course of a year plus, as we began to make some more traction on specific products and services and more for internal use, we quickly realized like this idea can be big. And so once we had that conclusion that the problem that we're trying to solve and the opportunity that the market presents is significant enough that it deserves to be, Braska deserves to be its own company. And that's when we kind of made a decision towards the fall of last year, was when I kind of more discreetly reached out to certain investors that I already had a pre-existing relationship with, or knew specifically was interested in this space. And really at that point, triangulating on what's the best fit from both capital need and the expertise support that we need from venture capitalists to decide on a lead investor. And that's kind of how we ran that process.
That's interesting that you saw this need and was looking into it without necessarily thinking it'd be a whole different company until you realize that, yeah, it did need to exist on its own. I guess talking about that, you know, how do you juggle your roles? We've talked about Nextseed, which was acquired by Republic a few years ago, and you work there as a executive. So how do you juggle these roles? How do they complement each other at the same time?
Yeah, well, my major role or effort at Republic right now is I'm in charge of Republic's Asia expansion efforts, and specifically, we actually set up and execute our own fintech, what we call Web 2.5 investment thesis via a venture capital fund ourselves. And through that fund we've made some investments, including in some in a local company here. And so from an investment thesis perspective, it's actually very consistent with what I believe is necessary for the world, and therefore Braska was born. So it's this idea of creating the infrastructure, right? We don't invest in applications, and that's probably the easy way to understand it. We don't invest in applications, we invest in infrastructure, because infrastructure, as we believe, is the first and the critical part before applications can be made on top of it. And so from that perspective, it's actually been very helpful for me to work both as an investor from a fund VC perspective, as well as an operator from a company building perspective. And the fact that from a venture capitalist perspective, you are exposed to so many different ideas and opportunities and entrepreneurs, most importantly, that reinforces or changes my thinking on the operating side and vice versa. As an operator, I'm working with just incredible colleagues we have across the divisions and departments and specialties we have. Like, insights we get there helps the investment fund become a better investor, because we are recognizing, and we are literally, we have our own R&D of what's coming down the pipeline, what view will probably be, you know, well taken, not well taken with the regulators. And so it's been a very symbiotic and synergistic arrangement for me personally.
And I feel like it also fuels your passion for democratizing opportunities and investment. So why has that emerged as a underlying theme to your whole career?
I think this, I might have talked about this in the past podcast, but to me, life is short. That's what I fundamentally believe. There's a lot of things happening in the world, and you know, if you don't enjoy what you work on, like, what's the point, right? So that's a more philosophical point. And for whatever reason, I hone in this idea. I like to think of my personal mission as democratizing finance to create opportunities for everyone. And that theme, you know, in slightly different variations, has been present across all the companies I work for and all the companies that we invest in now from our fund. And I think personally that's important to me because I am myself an immigrant. I was born in South Korea and moved to America when I was young. And obviously America, as you see the headlines, there's no perfection, right? There's a lot of issues, social issues, economic issues, political issues. And yet it's been, you know, the idea of American dream has been a consistent theme in world history, at least over the last couple hundred decades, or a couple hundred years, on what makes America special. And I think for me, having gone through that personal experience, I want to be able to create that opportunity for other people, because I had been helped by so many people to get to where I am. And without them, I wouldn't be here. And in my own way, because I can't control the world, I can't control really much in the global macro scale. In some ways, you know, starting a startup and working on a startup is one of the few ways that I think anyone can truly make an outsized impact. And I think that's why I was drawn to the idea of startups versus just working at a large institution for a long time, regardless of the, you know, compensation or status or title or anything like that. And from that perspective, to me, the financial system is the backbone, right? Like, whether you like it or not, we live in a capitalistic society. Obviously, we see some stress on that with, you know, recent macro events coming off COVID and now with the banking crisis. And that, I mean, in many ways, that's even more exciting to think about. Okay, so if this system that we live in today has some issues, some significant issues, are we as members of the human civilization going to just accept it and say, oh, this sucks, let's just like deal with it? Or are we willing to, you know, do something about it? And I know this is a bit cheesy, but to me, I'd like to think that we can do something about it.
Yeah, I don't think it's cheesy. I think it's extremely, I feel like if people are familiar with the NextSeed story of the opportunity you saw, like you said, kind of before it was even implemented, you saw this opportunity to open this store for investment. So I think it's cool. I assume that's kind of what you're doing now, is this opportunity before.
Correct. And I think in many ways, so it's funny because this is, and you've seen this story between the startups. The thing that we did at NextSeed that was most relevant to Brassica and arguably the most valuable is figuring out the technical and legal solutions, which is kind of tying across the banking and trust kind of infrastructure, because we ourselves use trust accounts at NextSeed to allow people to hold their money in a custodial account and then make investments and get paid distributions back. And we were doing that for literally a $100 investor. So like, you know, for those of you, those of the investors who made an investment on a local business, like some people would literally get like $1.05 back a month via distributions into their custodial account. So like that system of allowing someone to invest $100 and get, you know, $1 payments back on a monthly basis and doing like tens of thousands of them at the same time with a click of a button, that was an innovation. But the thing, and this is the entrepreneurship journey that I've been like, but like we weren't selling that, right? Like we were actually selling ultimately the ability for someone to invest into a local business they believed in, and the costs and efforts that we spent to build a system was not being monetized. And by the time I realized that, the company has come too far, and it was kind of difficult to, you know, pivot or something like that. And then COVID hit, and obviously the rest is history. But everything happens for a reason. And so having that insight, we want to amplify the fact that what we were able to do ourselves using the back end, we made it better, we made it bigger, we made it, you know, much more sophisticated to be able to handle different types of asset classes, including potentially digital assets in the future, so that other companies that are much better funded than NextSeed, that have much more, you know, like brilliant people working on from all the world, like we want them to learn from our mistakes and use our systems to make an even better product than what NextSeed had. And yes, like this, even though Brassica itself is a B2B enterprise for this reason, as we continue this journey, what we believe and what we hope to create is hundreds, thousands of companies that are using our systems, so that they, who are then dealing with their end consumers, can quote unquote democratize finance however they want to. And I think just to be clear, like when we think about democratized finance, like people kind of assume it's more like individual investors that are smaller dollar amounts. And that's not necessarily the case, right? There's actually a very significant number of high net worth individuals and institutions even they struggle to deal with the infrastructure of the kind of alternative space because the assets themselves are changing, right? Like if the system that we have right now in the traditional world is designed to track a certain type of asset or a certain type of product, what happens when those assets and products change, which it does every day? And so that flexibility to be able to like change the system, the infrastructure rather, to adapt to the changing world of assets, that's also what we want to hold on, is the flexibility to be able to, you know, change with the times and continue to be, you know, leading provider in this space for hopefully, you know, forever.
I guess to zoom out a little bit, I want to talk about the fintech space in general, mm-hmm. Just because I know you've now had your pulse on this ecosystem for over a decade. So how has the industry evolved? And we talked a little bit about this when we talked about crypto, but what's been some pivotal moments for the industry and where's it headed?
Yeah, I mean, we can really think about the last 12 years or so since the last financial crisis, 2008-09, because that's frankly where I got my start. I was fresh out of law school, starting my career at a law firm called Cleary Gottlieb, and our firm happened to be representing the Feds in the Lehman crisis. For listeners who even remember what that was, because at the time everyone thought the world was going to end, and that really shaped my view of the capital markets. Because, you know, until then, like you have this dream. You know, I was attending college in the 2000s and law school. The expectation was Wall Street and the smart people knew it, right? Like they could figure things out. And after the financial crisis, it was this fundamental shift in baseline assumptions about the knowledge and the skills and the expertise of Wall Street and arguably the US financial system. Since then, I mean, a bunch of laws have changed. I mean, Dodd-Frank is a major law that came out as of that. The irony, even as I think about it, the whole point of that law was they did not want to create banks too big to fail. And especially now, following the news of JP Morgan acquiring First Republic, arguably the world has become, some banks are like bigger than ever, so they can't ever fail. And literally they are effectively the banking system. And to me, that's very ironic, because the problems that we're trying to solve led to more problems or other problems that people either did anticipate or anticipated, but, you know, frankly, didn't care much about it. And so if you look at that prism of what the world has happened over the last 12 years in the financial crisis, I think there's been just infinitely more innovations that came as a direct response to the initial the global financial crisis. And case point, you know, the example number one is Bitcoin and the crypto industry. Like, Bitcoin was literally created as an aftermath of the financial crisis. And since then, the 10 years, the whether you like it or not, digital assets are here to stay. And the crypto industry is here to stay. And that has changed the world. Like, it's really changed the world. And related to that is laws have changed. Jobs Act also happened as a result, arguably, of the financial crisis. Jobs Act, when I started NextSeed, obviously the number was zero in terms of the amount of capital raised on these new exceptions, amount of access individuals and accredited investors, frankly, had on alternative assets. It was zero back in 2016 when the rules became finally real with SEC implementation, to now, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars, and it's just going to get bigger and bigger. So if you think about what has changed, it's literally everything. I think what hasn't changed is some people's opinion about the impact of some of these technologies. But I personally don't care about those opinions as much, not in a negative way, but as a practical way, because that's always the case with innovation, right? Some people believe it and some people don't. That's why some companies go out of business, like, you know, Blockbuster and Netflix being the perfect example of a technology change. So I think finance, the big difference in the financial industry from maybe a non-financial industry is the level of regulation, right? Because in a non-regulated industry, innovation wins. And if you innovate better, then you will win, because consumers will always just want a better solution. In a regulated industry, it doesn't matter necessarily how good an innovation is if it's illegal, right? And so there's a third component of regulations and government that must be taken into account if you're truly serious about fintech, because you're dealing with people's money and life savings and all this, you know, all the sensitive aspects of that dynamic. And I think that is what we're seeing today, is the amount of innovations, and especially the crypto industry, but, you know, in other industries as well, that have largely operated with less regulation than they otherwise would have if they were attacking like an existing, you know, heavily sophisticated and mature, you know, industry. And now, over the last 12 months, and especially the last 6 months, the pendulum has swung the other direction. So now there is a clearly much more kind of regulatory framework wrapped into, you know, some of these industries. So, and I think the industry is kind of grappling with what that means for them. And that's probably one of the things to kind of look out for going forward, is the importance of regulations and legal and compliance considerations in fintech in a way that perhaps, let's say, from 2017 to 2021, 2022, people didn't necessarily think about it as much because, frankly, there wasn't as much active involvement from the regulators.
Yeah, I guess aside from the regulatory challenges and the future of that, what else are you keeping a close eye on within the industry in terms of how
It's related to regulation, but it deserves its own reference, which is basically the rise of global hubs and rise of global markets. What I mean specifically is, if you think about the what people consider Web 2 and really the internet boom, like, I don't think anyone in the world would disagree that's a U.S. Win, right? Like, U.S. and Silicon Valley owned the internet. And when I say owned, I don't mean literally owned, but like they were the innovators, and all the ecosystem players, the companies, the investors, the entrepreneurs, they really kicked off everything about the internet and social media and everything else. And the rest of the world adopted those trends and then eventually made their own. And kind of fast forward to that era of, let's say, internet, web two from early, depending on where you want to start track, but really 2000s and maybe even the early, 2010s, rise of social media and, Facebook and Snap and companies of that ilk, Silicon Valley led. I would argue today that is not longer the case, and that is definitely not the case in Web3, right? Silicon Valley and US does not own or lead Web3, does not lead or own blockchain, and does not lead or own, frankly, a lot of related sectors and areas around that. And it's a combination of both the, I guess, political and regulatory decisions of the US environment, but also the opposite from international markets, right? Especially in Asia, there's South Korea passed its own regulatory framework governing securities token offerings. Jurisdictions like Singapore and Hong Kong are being very active. Europe just passed its own regulatory framework to cover digital assets and a much more broad framework for unified investment crowdfunding rules. So the rest of the world is basically trying to innovate because they have to. Right, like we can't just rely on whatever the countries had before, and so there's this massive, I would say, existential. And I don't mean to exaggerate, but I think that's what it is. There's an existential effort by countries around the world to build for their long term, for the next 100, 200 years of their society, and people see, whether you call it fintech, blockchain, or just any of these new technologies, as like this is the way to survive, because you can only find so much oil, and some countries don't have oil. That I think is a very important question that impacts far beyond startups and really the quality of life, the relative standing of nations, and that is something that I'm very, very focused on, both for company building, especially in this kind of Web3 space. But, frankly, in life.
Yeah. But kind of a bummer, like as Americans, right? Like the opportunities we could potentially miss out on.
I mean, that is one constructive feedback and criticism even that some, people in US and politicians even say, right? And I mean, you just to give an example, there's obviously a significant legal proceedings happening between Coinbase and SEC. It doesn't matter who's right or wrong. It's the fact that the arguably the leading company in the U.S., maybe even the world, that kind of started this kind of digital assets and crypto kind of business model, which is Coinbase, cannot kind of effectively work with its primary national regulators. And so I think that's probably the bigger issue. And I hope for the sake of U.S. innovation and U.S. development that, those parties can figure out a way to lead the industry together. But yeah, without it, if it's conflict, I think it is driving a lot of innovation outside. Having said that, the U.S. regulations and the U.S. economy is not going away, right, anytime soon. Like U.S. is the U.S. We are the number one by far, nation in the world in terms of economic activity, value created, and I'm biased, of course, but just the ability to get things done. And so how do we balance those kind of innate kind of cultural characteristics of the United States with a changing world order? I think it's going to be a very, very important, issue for all of us to think about.
Yeah, well, speaking of hubs, and obviously maybe not specifically the fintech world of Houston, but Houston as an innovation ecosystem. You've been along that ride now for a while. How have you seen Houston evolve as an innovation ecosystem? Do you see some room for improvement still for founders like yourself, for opportunities, I should say, for founders like yourself?
No, I think it's night and day. Since when I started 2014, there was nothing. So I think going from where we were as a city in 2014 to where Houston is today with so many amazing institutions and organizations and individuals and startups, I think the city has done an incredible job in kind of growing something from nothing almost. Having said that, obviously objectively it is not on the same level as some other major cities, and that's okay. I think Houston was always trying to figure out what makes sense for Houston. I would say, and I've shared this before with others in the ecosystem, that the key to kind of innovation ecosystem has to be the entrepreneurs, right? It cannot, by definition, be a top-down exercise because that, like, it just doesn't work. It can't be whether it's a kind of a corporate, you know, entity or a governmental entity saying this is important, let's do it. In terms of like kind of selecting who and how the funding will work and how the systems will be supporting, you know, certain type of investments, it really needs to be the individual, you know, the crazy ones, if you will, to say like, what do you want to do? You know, what do you need? And here it is, no questions asked. I think that kind of crazy mind is necessary to truly make changes happen in the world, regardless of the industry, regardless of the situation. There's no easy way to do that because, you know, we live again in a capitalist society. Like you can't literally just dump money on the streets and say, go for it. So you do need some rules and philosophy how to execute a certain strategy. So, you know, long story short, I think Houston has come a long way, but as a Houstonian, I think there's a lot more we can do. And I personally hope and we'll continue to try to support on my end, like how do we support the actual entrepreneurs first and foremost, versus how do we kind of satisfy more of a corporate objective perspective in executing the startup strategy?
Yeah, I feel like there's both happening in Houston, both that top down, and then there's the entrepreneurs that are just very proud to be in Houston. I talk to a lot of them and it's cool to see. But yeah, definitely maybe moving into the future, bridging that gap a little bit, but still cool to see, like you said, night and day in terms of the difference. Well, Young Bro, thank you so much for talking with me today. This was all very enlightening and exciting to hear your side of things and talking about fintech as a whole. A lot happening. So appreciate all of that.
Yeah, as always, and even this podcast didn't exist until, I don't know when it started, a few years ago. So I think these are signs of the times. And hopefully by having these more conversations, if we can, you know, inspire and help, you know, one more entrepreneur to do something that they might not have done otherwise, or one investor to make an investment they otherwise might not have considered. I think that's all moving the needle. And over time, that will make a difference.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hopefully we won't go another 100 episodes in between our conversations, but excited to catch up with you. And thanks again.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Houston Innovators Podcast. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss next week's edition, and check out innovationmap.com for the latest Houston startup and innovation news.